troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I am your host, Cameron English. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Paul Offit, who is a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, a vaccine expert, and the author of 11 books. And today, we're talking about his latest title, which is called Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. And the book is all about why some of our most common medical practices are actually unhelpful and might even be harmful, depending on what we're talking about. So, for example, treating a fever instead of letting it run its course can actually be very dangerous and has a serious impact on public health. So we're going to dive into this issue and some other really important topics discussed in the book. And of course, since Dr. Offit is a vaccine expert, we're going to discuss coronavirus a little bit because it's in the news and it's on everybody's mind. So thanks so much for listening. Here we go. All right, Dr. Paul Offit, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
Thank you, Cameron. I'm good.
So, of course, I want to talk about your new book, Overkill, but I feel like we have an obligation to at least mention the coronavirus pandemic. So just a couple of questions before that, before we get into the book. And just very briefly, what's your take overall on this pandemic we're going through as a physician and as someone who's developed vaccines? I mean, what are you thinking about right now dealing with this?
Well, I think it's tragic, you know, that we have a worldwide pandemic. I think the second part of this tragedy is to come. You know, as we have now 10 million Americans out of work, I think the estimates are probably conservative when they say that in the end, we could have as many as 35 million Americans out of work. What that will mean is massive joblessness, which leads to homelessness, food insecurity, domestic abuse, which has already gone up. Child abuse, depression, suicide. I think that's going to be round two of this. And that's another public health tragedy that we're about to face and I think will take us years to dig out of.
Right. So once we get past the virus, we have to deal with the actual fallout of trying to deal with it. So before we get there, before we get to that point, are you hopeful that there's going to be a vaccine relatively soon? I've heard reports that the virus isn't mutating too quickly, which is good news so far. I'm sure that can change. But are you hopeful that we can get a one-time vaccine for this thing? Or are you thinking it's going to be more complicated than that?
Well, I certainly think we can make a vaccine. I mean, early studies showed that at least with human coronavirus, that natural infection with one strain will protect you against moderate to severe disease associated with that, the challenge with the same strain. Those studies have been done, so that's good. I think we know the protein we're interested in. We're interested in that spike protein that's responsible for attaching to cells. If you can prevent that spike protein from attaching to cells with neutralizing antibodies, then I think you can prevent infection. So that's all good. And, you know, we live in an era of recombinant DNA technology where we should be able to make, to present that protein to the immune system, whether it's with messenger RNA or DNA or just a purified protein itself or with a vectored vaccine. I do worry only to the extent that I hope that this vaccine is tested extensively in an efficacy trial before it's given to people. There were some safety issues that were brought up with in experimental animals with the SARS vaccine. And so there are some, you know, biologically plausible concerns about this vaccine that makes me want to make sure that it's tested extensively. I mean, I'm on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. And although I'm not speaking for, in any sense for the FDA now, I do hope that this product or these products come through the FDA. I think they, once you start giving vaccines to tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people, many of whom will be healthy young people who are not likely to die from this virus, you want to make sure that it's safe.
Absolutely. So you obviously deal a lot with the anti-vaccine movement. I'm wondering, how have they reacted thus far? I've seen a couple conspiracy theories about how this was planned or, you know, the elite quote unquote knew it was coming or whatever, but how are they, what's the fallout going to be in terms of that debate as it relates to this pandemic?
Well, the true hardcore conspiracy theorist the true hardcore anti-vaccine activist is a conspiracy theorist. So they see conspiracy everywhere. They see conspiracy in that they think that the virus was manufactured, by some hostile group to hurt us all, or they think that it's overplayed, or that they think that the vaccine will be more dangerous than helpful. And that I think that they, even were there to be a vaccine, which was safe and effective, I wonder whether they would get it.
Well, I mean, we can only hope, right? But it just seems like this is the very situation experts like you have warned us about, not necessarily this particular virus, but, this is why we vaccinate it. So we don't end up in situations like this when we can avoid them. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, remember a typical epidemic influenza year will mean 300,000 to 500,000 cases or hospitalizations. It's 21 to 30 million cases, as many as 500,000 hospitalizations, as many as 60,000 deaths a year. And yet still those who are opposed to vaccine don't get a flu vaccine often. So, and we may or may not get in this country to where just epidemic flu is every year. I mean, as of this morning, it was about 11,000 deaths. I mean, maybe we'll get to 60,000 deaths. I know that the White House is predicting as many as 240,000 deaths. That would surprise me, but we'll see. I think my sense is we'll probably peak by the end of this month, by the end of April, and start to see the doubling times spread out much more dramatically so that we know that at least hospitals won't be overwhelmed and we can go back to work, but we'll see.
All right. Well, we'll monitor it closely. Obviously, everyone's glued to social media and the news trying to keep track of this thing. But I really do want to talk about Overkill, which is an excellent book. I'm really enjoying it as I wrap up reading it. And the last time you were here, I asked you, or rather you answered that you wrote this book knowing you were going to make more enemies because you're tackling a lot of sacred cows and not just among, the anti-vax crowd or the conspiratorial crowd, but actual mainstream medicine in many cases. So let me ask you, what's the thesis of the book, first of all, and then why did you decide to go this route with this book?
Well, the thesis is that there are situations in modern medicine where we have abundant scientific evidence that we shouldn't be doing something, but we do it anyway. So treating fever can prolong or worsen illness. Finishing the antibiotic course is often unnecessary. So then there's abundant evidence for that, but you bring up an interesting point. The notion that anybody would attack me is really irrelevant. It's not about me. It's about the scientific studies that prove my point. I feel the same way about those who are opposed to vaccines. I mean, the vaccines stand on a mountain of evidence. The book Vaccines, Plotkin's Vaccine, this is a 1,600-page book that has 20,000 references in it that show that vaccines are what they're claimed to be, safe and effective. So you can attack the editors of that book, or you can attack those who promote the themes of that book. But the fact of the matter is, it's the evidence. It's the problem. I mean, I've always said this about the anti-vaccine people. I'm not their problem. The studies that show that they're wrong are their problem. And the same thing would be true here. It's not about me. It's about the data. If you think the data are incorrect, what is it about the data that show that they're incorrect?
Now, just for clarification, all these issues, and I want to talk, you mentioned fever and antibiotics, which are the two most interesting, in my opinion, that I want to talk about in a minute. But are you expecting any pushback from your colleagues on this? Is there any legitimate scientific opposition to what you're saying? Or is this just a case of clinicians and maybe even researchers ignoring what the science tells us?
Well, I definitely think there'll be pushback. I mean, I talk about, for example, how knee arthritis doesn't need to be treated with arthroscopic surgery. I talk about how heart stents have been shown to be, for the most part, useless. That medical therapy, lowering the cholesterol, making sure that the blood pressure is in control, good control, is just as good as putting in heart stents. So, I mean, those are lucrative industries. Surgeons have that as lucrative procedure. So I'm sure there'll be pushback on that because you're sort of threatening somebody's livelihood. I think for the most part, what I'd like to believe, doctors are trying to do good. They want to help their patients, and they get into these established ways of treatment that sometimes, as we learn over time, are wrong. There were certainly things that I learned as a pediatrician in the late 1970s when I was training that were just dead wrong. And so you change. So I think one is inertia. I think the second is that there is often a financial interest. And So we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. And I think sometimes people just don't know. I mean, I do think, you know, doctors aren't, you know, reading every journal every day, keeping up. And so sometimes you just don't know about these things. Hopefully there'll be some that who will read this, or many that will read this will say, thank you. That's helpful. I never thought of it that way. I appreciate it, which is kind of like a Leave It to Beaver moment, but I still think it's possible.
One thing that popped out at me when I started reading this book was the idea that mainstream medicine and mainstream science, they give fuel to critics in the anti-vaccine movement or the anti-GMO movement or whatever their particular boogeyman is. When mainstream science ignores the evidence it has, it gives fuel to these people. And I remember doing the first major interview I did on a podcast a couple of years ago, and the feedback I got from most of the listeners that I interacted with was, well, science gets it wrong all the time. You know, these people don't even follow their own evidence. And so I'm wondering, are you concerned that if we continue following this bad advice or ignoring the evidence, we're going to make this problem worse of people distrusting science?
Well, see, I think science doesn't get it wrong. I think science eventually gets it right. I think scientists get it wrong. I mean, scientists may, you know, put out a paper that's shown to be wrong, and that happens again and again. I mean, you know, Nobel Prizes have been awarded for things like, you know, lobotomies and for a worm causing stomach cancer. And, you know, people were confident that you know, butter was bad for you because it was loaded with unsaturated fats, which kind of drove us into the waiting arms of trans fats. And so people will look at that, I think you're right, and they'll say, see, that's why you can't trust science. But eventually science does get it right. I mean, it happens in fits and starts, it lurches forward, but it always does move forward. So I think you can trust science, you can trust the process, the scientific method. But I think scientists get it wrong all the time, and that's okay. I mean, it's the good thing about science is it's not fixed. It's always mutable. We're willing to take a textbook and throw it over our shoulder without a backward glance as we learn more and more information. You always have to be open to new information if the data are solid and supportive.
So in other words, then people will come along with you over time. You think it just might take a while to you know, get the old habits die hard, is the old adage, right? Is that just what we're dealing with?
Yes, exactly right. I think, okay. You know, that probably especially the notion of that finishing the antibiotic course is often necessary. That is so ingrained. And similarly with fever, you know, to change the culture, you would have to change an entire culture to get people not to treat fever. But I think people should learn about the purpose of fever, learn about how we came to pick these arbitrary times to treat a variety of infections, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, let's get into both of those because those are both great examples. So give me an elevator pitch. So my kid's in bed sick with a horrific fever. He's miserable. And all I want to do as a parent is make him feel better. And so make the case. Why should I not treat his fever?
Well, so the question is, why do we have fever? All of us make fever. Our body thinks it's important when we're infected to make fever. Why would we do that? The reason we do that is simple. As has been shown over and over again, our immune system works better at a higher temperature. So when you look at experimental animal studies where they treat or don't treat animals that are infected with a variety of viruses or bacteria, those who are given medicines that lower fever, those animals always do worse. They have more prolonged illness or fatal illness as compared to those who weren't given these fever-reducing medicines. And the same thing is true now in humans. We have about six or seven studies that have clearly shown that if you take people and give them a fever-reducing medicine for their illnesses, they last longer. Probably the best in pediatrics is chickenpox. Children who had chickenpox either were treated or not treated with Tylenol. And what you found was that those who were treated had a longer time till those blisters crusted over and had a longer time of illness. It's fever is good for you. It's just when we treat fever, we feel better. So we assume that there's no harm in doing it, but there has clearly been shown to be harm in doing it.
So talk a little bit about how the fever enhances your immune response to an infection, because that was very fascinating, and I'm sure most people don't really know how that works.
Right. So when you're infected with a bacteria or a virus, for example, you generate a host of proteins that then travel to your hypothalamus, which is located sort of deep in the center of your brain. And then what that does is through a chemical known as prostaglandin E2, it changes your set point for your temperature. I mean, normally you're around 98.6. This changes the set point to be much higher, 101, 102 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. So you shiver, you shunt blood from your arms and legs into your core. You feel cold. You want to dress more warmly. You put a log on the fire. You get underneath the covers. You shiver, which also generates heat. You do all that for the purpose of raising your temperature. You want to raise your temperature. Your body wants you to be warmer. Because when you're warmer, the white blood cells that kill bacteria are able to kill those bacteria more efficiently. When you're warmer, the B cells that, you know, through the help of T cells make antibodies, make those antibodies more efficiently. The cytotoxic T cells, which are special immune cells in your body that help kill virus-infected cells, also are more efficient at killing. That's been shown in vitro, or meaning in the laboratory, again and again and again. So it all makes sense. We physiologically pay a price for fever. I mean, for every degree centigrade increased in temperature, we have an increase in our basal metabolic rate of about 12%. We spend a lot of energy making fever. Our body, you know, makes a commitment to making fever for a reason. And that's the reason. And so there's never been an animal model study done that I've ever seen where it's shown that treating fever was in any sense beneficial. And I've seen the same thing with human studies. It's not helpful. You feel better. So you think, okay, well, that means I am better. But if you look at the sort of objective criteria, like, you know, how long does your runny nose last, or how severe is that runny nose? It's generally you'll shed virus for longer. Your symptoms will be of longer duration and more severe, the symptoms of the basic illness, when you treat fever.
So is this just, like my hypothetical parent a moment ago, this is just people trying to take care of their kids and maybe pharmaceutical companies making products that are responding to that demand? Is that really all we're dealing with in terms of treating fever, even though it's not the best idea?
True. It's not fun having fever. I mean, when you have fever, you know, you sort of have muscle aches or joint aches. You know, you can have a headache and you have chills. That's not fun. The symptoms of fever aren't fun. They are there for a reason, though. I mean, I'll give you an example. In our hospital, we had a child who was about 15 years old, who was a soccer player, and he hit his hip with a soccer ball, and he developed something called a septic thrombophlebitis, which is a bacterial infection of the vein. The bacteria then went from his vein to his lungs, causing lung abscesses, went to his brain, causing brain abscesses, went to his bones and joints, causing also abscesses, meaning collections of pus. And he had this strain of bacteria called MRSA in his bloodstream day after day after day, and every day he was treated every 2 hours with an anti-fever medicine, whether it was ibuprofen or Tylenol. Every day, day after day, every 2 hours, he was treated to try and fight against the fever that his body was so desperately trying to make. And finally, I sat down with the parents, I sat down with the nurses, and I sat down with the child and said, you know, he was a teenager, and said, you know, let's stop this. Let's give fever a chance to work for you. And he was brave, and his parents were game, and the nurses were willing. And what ended up happening over the next day and a half is finally, after day after day after day of having bacteria in his bloodstream, those bacteria finally disappeared. And the parents thought we were brilliant. I mean, it may have been that would have happened anyway, but that's not the way the parents saw it. And I think really we did help that child. And so we are in our hospital now really trying to step back on this zealous over-treatment of fever.
And let me run this statistic by you. This is from the book. I just want to make sure I have it correct. So I believe you said that because we treat fever, flu kills an additional 40,000 people every year around the world. Is that right?
Right. That was sort of a population study that came out of England showing that see, when you treat fever, you feel better. So you think, okay, now I can go outside and hang out. Same thing you could argue for this COVID-19 outbreak. When you treat a fever associated with this, if it's a mild infection and you're in the early part of your illness, you know, you think, okay, I mean, you may not be someone who has congestion or even a mild cough. And just let's say you just have fever. So now you go outside because you feel better. But, you know, you're not better. And the fact is you're still excreting the virus. And in that study that was done looking at influenza, they looked at countries that did or didn't treat zealously for fever and came to the conclusion that you had far more cases of the disease and far more deaths associated with the disease in those countries that were vigorous users of fever-reducing medicine.
Okay. So there is a real cost, in other words. This isn't just Paul Offit, you know, nitpicking or you know, just trying to be a contrarian for the sake of it. But this really does cost people's lives. So that's an important point to keep in mind. Let's move on to antibiotics. Just lay out your argument here, because it is very interesting and it makes perfect sense. But for some reason, this is not how we think about antibiotics today for the most part. So lay out your argument on this issue.
Yeah, my argument is treat the patient. I mean, if someone has asthma, we give them bronchodilators until their wheezing's gone. If someone has pain, we give them pain-reducing medicine until their pain is gone. We don't then treat them for another 5 or 7 or 14 days after they're better. I think you can make the same argument here. Why set an arbitrary time at the beginning of illness? And now study after study has shown that. So, for example, if you have an infection of your bladder and you have white blood cells in your urine and you have bacteria in your urine, and then you treat with an antibiotic for a day or two or three, and then the bacteria are gone, the white cells are gone, the pain is gone, why are we still treating? And so studies have looked at that, whereas often people will treat for 5 or 7 or 10 or 14 days. Studies now have clearly shown for a bladder infection, you only need to treat for 3 days. And now basically advisory committees have made that recommendation based on those data, and still we don't do it. Same thing for kidney infections, which we would often treat for 10 or 14 days. Now you find that there's study after study showing you can treat for 5 or 7 days. You don't need to treat that long. Or bacterial pneumonia, even bacterial pneumonia that causes you to be in the intensive care unit. You know, study was done saying, okay, let's do this. We'll let one group of doctors treat for as long as they want, and we'll let the other group of doctors treat for only 2 days after the person has fever has come down. And so it ended up being that when you use that method, meaning just treat for 2 afebrile days, that the length of treatment was only 5 days, as compared to the other group where it was 10 to 14 days. And there was no difference in outcomes. The reason it's important is, you know, don't give a medicine if you don't need it anymore, because only bad things can happen, and they are happening. We have a growing a population of bacteria that are resistant to all commercially available antibiotics. We're losing antibiotics. We're moving into a post-antibiotic era. You know, we're using things like bacteriophages to treat people, which is to say, viruses that kill bacteria. I mean, that was written about in Sinclair Lewis's book, Arrowsmith, 100 years ago, you know, before we had antibiotics. I mean, we're really going back to a past when we didn't have antibiotics and are using things like viruses that kill bacteria. It's a desperate time. So certainly, one, don't use antibiotics for viral infections, but two, don't use antibiotics longer than you need them.
Now, I believe you say that it's between 30 and 75% of antibiotic prescriptions are just not necessary for two of the reasons you just mentioned. But it's really that clear now that doctors are, let me back up. Are doctors just prescribing these willy-nilly, or is it just a misunderstanding of what the medicines are for?
I think when somebody goes to the doctor, they want to feel that something is being done. And when they walk out with a prescription, they feel that something's being done. So even if you have a cold or a severe cold, or you have, you know, bronchitis, which is just inflammation of the trachea and so the first tubes that come off the trachea, the bronchi, those are invariably viral infections. So don't treat them. But people are used to treating with antibiotics and then they get better. Of course, they would have gotten better anyway, except the problem is that, you know, they may suffer the side effects of antibiotics, not the least of which is creating resistant bacteria for when you actually really do have a bacterial infection. But I think a lot of it is just, you know, the people, doctors are often graded by their patients. And that can determine, you know, a number of things for those doctors. They want patients to like them. And I think they know that they'll be rated much more highly if they do what the patient wants. So they end up acting more like waiters in a restaurant than doctors in a hospital. I mean, the doctor's job is to help the patient through the dense thicket of medical information to help them work together to make the right decision. But I think we've sort of moving into the notion of just doing what makes people happy.
right. And there's a great anecdote in the book I want to get into in just a minute related to that. But to finish off this antibiotic issue, the justification I've heard all my life is that you're supposed to take this medication because it'll kill all of the susceptible bacteria. And if you stop too soon, well, then those will survive. And then you have a real problem on your hands. But that's basically backwards, if I understand you correctly. So where did that logic come from?
I think it came from the early days of antibiotics when we didn't have enough antibiotics, meaning we didn't have high enough doses, especially in the early days of penicillin. And so you know, you would give really suboptimal doses, stop the antibiotic, and then the infection would come back. I mean, we don't live in that era anymore, so we don't need to do that anymore. It's wholly unnecessary. And It's false reasoning. People will say, well, you know, you should make sure all the susceptible bacteria are killed. I think you can make the case that if you're not seeing the bacteria anymore in the urine or because from a kidney or bladder infection, or you're not seeing, you know, or you're seeing the immune response start to abate. I mean, when the immune response, the purpose of the immune response is to kill the bacteria. That's why it's there. When the immune response starts to abate, which is to say you feel better, your fevers come down, you're breathing more comfortably, whatever the infection was, you can assume that bacterial replication is no longer an important part of that process anymore. Once your immune system throws up its hands and says, we're done, our job is done here, which is what the Lone Ranger would always say. The immune system doesn't actually talk, but if it could, that's what it would say.
Right. And that's because the virus is no longer replicating. And so your immune system doesn't sense a threat. And so all of those immune responses that we typically have, that's the indication, right? That you're good. Stop taking the medicine. Is that the fair takeaway there?
Exactly. I mean, if your immune response starts to abate, I mean, let's say you have a bacterial pneumonia. Now your fevers come down. Now you're breathing more comfortably. That tells you your immune response is saying, we have killed the bacteria we needed to kill. So you don't need to give antibiotics anymore at that point. And I just think we are slowly coming to that realization. You know, there's an article in a British medical journal that the title of which was, you know, is this the end of the antibiotic course? Because I think we're getting to the point where you don't have to have this predetermined length of therapy at the beginning of illness. Treat the patient. If the patient's gotten better, then stop.
Right. Okay. Well, Something important to keep in mind. Final question on this, though. I've seen some recent research where they're using existing drugs off-label to stop harmful bacteria from developing resistance in the first place. First, are you familiar with that research? And then do you think that's a promising route to keeping these medicines effective in the next, I don't know, decade or so?
So give me a specific example of what you mean.
So, and it gets technical quick, so I don't want to get too deep into it. But basically, they expose the bacteria to a drug that prevents it from swapping genes with other bacteria in the environment, which is where that I believe that resistance comes from. So if you can stop them from developing resistance in the first place, then antibiotics will remain effective. So we don't have to dive too deeply into that, but do you have any thoughts there?
Yes. No, I think that any strategy that lengthens the period of time during which we can stay in the antibiotic era, I think is a good idea. So I think those are clever strategies. We'll see how it plays out. But I think probably the most important thing that we can do is not take antibiotics for viral infections, which probably accounts for 70% of the inappropriate use of antibiotics.
Very good. Well, let's go back then to this idea of doctors as customer service representatives. And you have it's sad, but it's also entertaining, this anecdote about a patient who rated her doctor negatively right after leaving the office. So can you tell that story and then we'll dig into that a little deeper?
Sure. I think when a patient comes in with an infection that they think is treatable with an antibiotic, they want that prescription. They see themselves as a customer, not as someone who is there to avail themselves of someone else's expertise and experience. They are there to get a product. And when they don't, occasionally when they don't get it, they're angry. And so they'll go right online and rate their doctor badly. And doctors, you know, they're educable. They learn about how this Pavlovian conditioning works. So when they keep getting negative reviews, they just eventually throw their hands up in the air and say, okay, I'll write the prescription. And it's not us at our best. It's easy to see how we can come to that, but it certainly doesn't help our patient or the environment to prescribe antibiotics inappropriately.
Sure. Well, let me play devil's advocate just for a second. You've probably gotten this complaint or you will, I'm sure you've seen it, but I mean, the pushback is, well, doctors need to be held accountable because, as you said earlier, they do get things wrong. And so the patient should be able to, you know, discuss their experience and talk to the other patients. I mean, shouldn't we have some kind of accountability for physicians?
Sure. I think we should ask our doctors why they're making the choices that they're making, on what evidence are those choices being made. Of course, I think you should hold people to a high level of accountability, especially when you put anything into your body. I think you should be a skeptic. But I don't think you should be a cynic, which is to say, I don't think you should cross that line from skepticism to cynicism, which is to say that if those answers make sense, and you are going to someone who does have more expertise and experience than you have in that subject, but you should be a good customer. I agree with that. I think that's fine. But again, it's not I mean, I guess in the vaccine world, when there are people who ask legitimate questions, they want answers. And I think you, if you can present those data that that address the issues that they're worried about in a compelling and passionate and compassionate way, then great. And often I think people are convinced, but some people just feel that they know better, that they're not interested in what you have to say. And that's where it gets frustrating.
Right, Google experts. So I guess the point is we want informed and perhaps skeptical patients, but we need to get rid of this, what I like to call the "let me talk to your manager" mentality when it comes to medicine, right? Because we're not talking to the cable company; we're talking to somebody who spent years in school and is trying to help you get better. So maybe that's an important point. One thing you said that I thought was very interesting was that we need to just eliminate jury trials when it comes to medical malpractice. So. Tell the psychic story, if you would, because it's just ridiculous. I couldn't believe that was true. Tell that story, then let's talk a little bit about, the court system in medicine.
Right. No, I think the as compared to when I trained, back in the 70s, we're a much more litigious society. And I do think that physicians are aware of that. And when they say that they're going to be conservative in their treatment, what they mean is that they're going to do something that makes them less likely to be sued, because as a general rule, you're sued for not doing something, i.e. not giving an antibiotic, than for having a side effect from an antibiotic, which is a known side effect. The one I point to in the book, because I think that people that jury trials are composed of people who don't have an expertise in that subject, and so they're going to be swayed by the emotion rather than by the data. But and then the case I gave was a woman who was a psychic. She had a headache. She went to a neurologist at Temple University School of Medicine in Philadelphia, and the neurologist, as part of the workup, did a CT scan, after which she claimed to have lost her psychic powers. She was a psychic who worked for the police department, which is probably the most depressing part of the story to me. But she claimed that she lost her capacity to earn a living. So she sued the Temple neurologist for having gotten that CT scan and causing her to lose the psychic powers. She won initially a verdict of $2.5 million. That was on appeal, it was the amount of the money was reduced, but the verdict wasn't changed. I mean, so in other words, for her to have won that trial, the jury had to believe, one, that people have psychic powers to lose, two, that they can lose them in a CT scan, and three, that the neurologist should have known better than to have gotten a CT scan on a psychic. I mean, what was he thinking? I think if I were on the defense team, I would have argued that she should have seen it coming, right? But I'm not sure they made that argument.
I mean, I don't know. That sounds like an airtight case to me, because there are psychics everywhere, Dr. Offit. I mean, that's an extreme example, but this happens all the time, as you very well know. But in medicine and many fields of science, you have these product liability lawsuits where the evidence clearly shows that the product is not harmful or the physician didn't make a mistake. And nonetheless, because you have a plaintiff's attorney that can spin a good sob story or seems to have compelling data, you get a jury of lay people that will just effectively write checks for millions or maybe even billions of dollars. And so this is a real threat to innovation in medicine and in agriculture right now. Bayer's facing something like 40,000, maybe more lawsuits for a pesticide that every regulatory agency has said is safe. And so tell me about the solution you have to eliminating this. We wouldn't have jury trials. We would have what?
Well, trials where at least there's a representative expertise on the jury, so that that if it's a trial about, say, glyphosate, which may be what you're referring to there, but
right.
The pesticide. I mean, if you look at the data on glyphosate, there's no evidence that it causes cancer. None. Any decent study has not been able to support that. Yet, I think it's Monsanto that's going to it's getting hammered on this. And. And so, therefore, we lose a very effective pesticide, which is safer than most of the other pesticides out there, because it's not hard to convince juries that something is dangerous. They're not going to necessarily understand the way those studies are done, or they're going to be more influenced by poorly done studies or by someone who is not a very good scientist but is very good at convincing juries, as compared to someone who's a very good scientist but just doesn't have the personality that works as well to convince juries. It shouldn't come down to that. And so in a better world, and this will never happen, by the way, ever in my lifetime, is you would have because I think the Trial Lawyers Association is way too powerful, is to have jury trials with people who actually have an expertise in the field, that represent the experts in the field. You know, when I go to, I'm on the FDA's vaccine advisory committee. When we sit around and make decisions about, for example, what are going to be next year's flu strains, which we did at the end of February, sitting around that table are flu experts. I mean, they know this story, and it's just a pleasure actually to sit you know, around with a group of, you know, 8 or 10 people who have spent their lifetime studying that virus. It matters, and ultimately the country, this country, the society benefits from that expertise.
Now, if you go out for jury duty now, and it's a murder trial, and they find out that you're, say, related to a cop, or you're related to someone who works in the criminal justice system, they say, okay, hey, you have a nice life, take care, drive safe, we don't want you on our jury. Is it the same thing in medical related lawsuits right now? If you're a physician or if you work in the healthcare system, are you more likely to get dismissed from a jury?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. They don't want anybody who has an expertise on there that would have an opinion that may influence the you know, the opinion of the other jurors. They want to be the only ones that are influencing that opinion. They don't want a juror with an expertise to say, look, I'm a doctor and this is what I think about this. They don't want that.
Well, that's sad. So we have it backwards. So maybe we can turn it around. All right. Well, so the book is called Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. Dr. Offit, give us your website, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff, and then plug anything that you're working on right now.
The book is it's easily purchased on Amazon or in bookstores. Presumably it comes out April 14th. I do have a website that's like paul-offit.com or something like that. I can never remember my website.
No, that's right. I double checked it.
Is that right? Okay, good. And yeah. I'm like I think my Twitter is at Dr. Paul Offit. It shows you what a social media animal I am that I can't remember.
Well, you're pretty active on Facebook, if I remember. That might be a good place for people to follow.
That's true. I am active on Facebook. So that's it. I mean, I'm also working on another book that's called The Learning Curve, The Real Stories Behind Modern Medicine's Greatest Advances, just to make the case that anytime we have a medical advance, invariably there's a human price to pay. And so I'm working on that. That's been fun. But this book, I'm looking forward to this book. It's more of an advice book than I typically write, but hopefully people will enjoy it.
Yeah. And there's good stuff. I was surprised to see some of the things in there. You know, but hey, you follow the data where it leads. So we'll stop there and we'll let people just go read the book. But Dr. Paul Offit, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Cameron. My pleasure.